KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Coquel Indian Tribe and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs recently signed a formal agreement. The agreement creates a framework for collaboration and to increase resources to support Native veterans in accessing federal and state veterans benefits. According to a press release, the Memorandum of Understanding paves the way for the establishment of the tribe's first Tribal Veteran Service Officer, which will jointly be funded by the tribe and state agency. The service officers help veterans and their families in accessing benefits. They're trained by the State Veterans Affairs Department and accredited by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. This is the fifth such agreement. The others are with the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and the Crow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians. There are 9 federally recognized tribes in the state. Last week, California Assembly lawmakers approved a bill to grant military retirees and their dependents up to $20,000 as a state tax exemption. The bill was introduced by Native American Assembly member James Ramos. In a statement, he said the bill is intended to acknowledge the many sacrifices of military retirees and their families and serve as an incentive to keep them in California. California does not offer tax exemption on military pensions. Advocates of the bill say if a tax exemption were in place, gains for the state would include more jobs and an economic boost. The bill is supported by a number of veterans organizations across the state. The measure heads to the Senate. Native experts in foraging for traditional foods are sharing some of their recommendations. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports.
In Papago Park, east of Phoenix, Twyla Cassador points to the base of a Palo Verde tree where small branches, dried leaves, and other plant matter have formed the ground nest of a desert wood rat. Cassador says the rodent is both a source of nutrition and knowledge.
And many of us may not think much about the desert wood rat, but as people that study environmental science or engineering, this friend of ours, also a delicious friend, will tell us about climate change.
Cassador is a traditional food forager and educator with the San Carlos Apache tribe. She explains to a tour organized by the Society of Environmental Journalists that other researchers have found that as the planet warms, the wood rat uses larger plant material to shade or insulate its home. But where the rat is plentiful, as it is here in the Sonoran Desert, it can also be a source of what Cassador calls pre-reservation food, food from before the years when the U.S. government forced Native people away from their longtime homes.
They took everyone away from the landscape where they originally foraged from and hunted from.
Helping Cassador with the effort to discover more traditional foods is Jeffrey Lazos Ferns, a naturalist and member of the Pascua Yaqui tribe. He points to blossoms and seeds on the Palo Verde tree.
These flowers, you can make tea out of them. Also, the pods, which you maybe see on some of the more younger trees out here, they taste like edamame, so you can eat them fresh off the tree, or you can peel them, boil them, put salt on them, or store them for the season that you actually do want to use them.
Lazos Fern says some larger cities like Tucson have started to plant more indigenous plants that need less water or no fertilizer and be a source of food or medicine. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Arctic Encounter 2025, July 30th to August 1st in Anchorage, Alaska, to shape policy, investment, and innovation in the far north. Early bird registration closes June 15th at arcticencounter.com.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
The gravest concern is that the state has been leaving some money on the table that it could be collecting from oil and gas companies in taxes.
Legislative leaders send a strongly worded letter to Governor Dunleavy over access to oil tax information. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, federal funding cuts could eliminate a book loan program for rural libraries.
I don't think we've even started to comprehend how we're going to adapt yet. We are still sort of like a little bit shell-shocked at what's happening.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The legislative session ended last month, but tension persists between the governor and state lawmakers. In late May, legislative leaders sent Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy a letter criticizing the Department of Revenue for, as the letter put it, obstructing the legislature's access to information on oil and gas taxes. Specifically, lawmakers have been trying to figure out if the state is getting the tax money it is owed. According to the Anchorage Daily News, the last such review covered a time period from 2006 to 2011 and found the state was owed more than $1 billion in taxes. That review was in 2018. Dunleavy has been governor since then, and the administration has refused to give legislators the same information that previous administrations gave up willingly. ADN reporter Iris Samuels says the letter is just the latest chapter in a long-running saga spanning pretty much the entire Dunleavy administration.
These numbers are pretty basic, and what the legislative auditor has said is if the Department of Revenue is not collecting this information in this particular easily digestible form, that in itself is cause for concern, because we should really know pretty offhand, pretty easily, how much the state is assessing in extra taxes every year.
Right. So, I mean, there's this letter, but then this past practice of the Department of Revenue willingly providing this information to the legislature is also now the subject of a bill that seeks to compel the administration to do that. And I guess part of this is also that those legislators are concerned that the governor might veto that bill, right?
Right. So lawmakers basically got together this year and passed this bill that is meant to underscore existing powers that the state, that the legislative auditor has. So it's really not giving the legislative auditor new powers. It's just a bill that says these are the authorities of the legislative auditor, whose role is defined in the state constitution, and basically asking in a new form the administration of the governor to comply with requests that come from the legislative auditor. And then going to this letter, the letter accompanied the bill. And so the goal there from the House Speaker and the Senate President was to send a message to the governor, who is no stranger to the veto pen, hey, please don't veto this particular piece of legislation.
Yeah, tell me more about the extraordinary nature of that, because I think, you know, some people might look at it and say, okay, well, they sent him a letter, so what? It's just a letter. But that's actually pretty rare for this kind of a circumstance, right?
Yeah, to be fair, I haven't been covering the legislature for that long, but I've never heard of the presiding officers sending a letter directly to the governor to accompany a piece of legislation. And what this letter says is basically that this goes to the very heart of state government in Alaska, and this idea that we have a legislative branch, we have an administration, and they should really be working together for the benefit of the people of Alaska, not working as sort of opposing sides. So it remains to be seen. And he could actually, you know, take the letter to heart. And we really don't know what's behind all this. Again, in theory, the gravest concern is that the state has been leaving some money on the table that it could be collecting from oil and gas companies in taxes. But we don't know if that's the case. Maybe the state is actually performing the audits as it has in the past. It's collecting all this extra revenue, and we just don't know.
I guess, I mean, we also don't know why, right? You know, I mean, speaking of Gary Stevens, Senate President Gary Stevens, his quote in your story was something about, you know, we don't know if this is incompetence or, you know, these folks are incapable of doing this work. What do you think about that? I mean, have you gotten any indications that it's just, it's too much of a burden to put this together? People are not doing their jobs, or is the information actually being like withheld for some reason?
I reached out to the Department of Revenue with questions for this story, and I did not get a response. But one thing that is worth pointing out is that several pretty high-up officials within the Department of Revenue have left under the tenure of the current Commissioner of Revenue, and that's Adam Crum. Adam Crum is actually the third Revenue Commissioner under Governor Dunleavy. He really has not spoken publicly about this. He was invited to address a legislative committee hearing when the legislature was still in session, and he didn't show up. And that caused a lot of House members who are in that committee to be quite upset. The legislative leaders really were wanting to hear directly from the source about what was behind all of this, again, under the assumption that potentially there is a perfectly reasonable explanation.
Which we're still waiting to hear, right?
Right.
Where does this go from here? We're just sort of on a veto watch.
Yeah, I think we'll wait to see what happens with this piece of legislation. And then regardless of what happens, we're still waiting for the results of this audit. We really just want to know, bottom line, we really want to know, is the state collecting the tax revenue that it is owed?
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Iris Samuels. Find her full story at ADN.com. The State Board of Education is considering a regulation change that would further limit how much money local governments can give to school districts. At its regularly scheduled meeting tomorrow, the board will decide whether to adopt it as an emergency regulation or to open the 30-day comment period for the proposed change. The new regulation would narrow the definition of what kind of spending counts as a local contribution. State law currently limits how much municipalities can give to districts. Several school districts interpret the limit to apply only to money for instructional services. Some municipalities, like the city and borough of Juneau, give additional money to their school districts for non-instructional services like transportation and preschool. The regulation change would end this practice. Leadership from the Alaska Council of School Administrators said in an email that the change could affect districts that represent nearly half of the state's students. The Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, or DEED, drafted a version of the change last November. The board will decide tomorrow whether to consider the current version as an emergency regulation. That means the board could approve the change without a public comment period. It would take effect immediately after approval from the state's lieutenant governor. If approved as an emergency regulation, the change would last only 120 days unless the board later approved a permanent regulation change. The board may also consider the regulation without emergency status and open a 30-day public comment period before taking action. DEED wrote in a memo to the board that it's proposing the change to match federal definitions and to remain in compliance with a yearly federal disparity test. The non-instructional local contributions have not been considered in the test. One of the state's legislative fiscal analysts says it also was not included in this year's test, which the state failed. DEED officials did not respond to questions today. The board will decide whether to open a 30-day public comment period during its meeting tomorrow. DEED has requested the board include the regulation change at a special meeting in July if the board opens public comment this week. There's also an opportunity for the public to comment on agenda items early Wednesday during the virtual board meeting. Meeting information can be found on the board's website. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau schools will increase access to Thlinkit culture and language programs.
the urgency to put intensive amount of support and instruction into the TCLL program was asked of us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It doesn't matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, or what you agreed to in the past. Sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through multiple resources. Visit notaloneak.org to find help for yourself or a loved one. Remember, it's not your fault. This message sponsored by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Bad weather has halted a search for a 41-year-old mountaineer who's missing after falling Monday off the west buttress of Denali. National Park Service spokesperson Angie Smiegel said a ground search was called off today after heavy winds and snow set in. She says they're monitoring conditions every hour in hopes the weather will calm enough to restart the search. Smiegel said three ski mountaineers set out on an expedition Monday to ascend the peak. She said when they reached the 12,000-foot level, two of the mountaineers saw the third member fall at a spot called Squirrel Point. They said he fell towards an ice formation on the rocky 3,000-foot face of the Peters Glacier. Smiegel declined to identify the missing mountaineer, but said he's a 41-year-old resident of Washington State. She said all three of the expedition members were unroped. She said the Park Service highly recommends that precaution for all climbers and mountaineers. According to a Park Service news release, the two remaining expedition members lowered themselves over the edge of the west buttress as far as possible, but were unable to see or hear the missing mountaineer. So they descended the route to seek additional help. They're now at Camp 1, where they're being treated and evaluated by a ranger team. Smiegel said the Park Service hopes to resume the ground and air search later today or Wednesday. An Anchorage woman is accused of neglecting dozens of dogs at a local home in a case that's prompted an outpouring of adoptions and donations. 47-year-old Monica Marshall faces 73 misdemeanor counts of animal neglect in the case, which involves 71 dogs and two birds. According to the charges, police and animal control officers responded May 22nd to a report of neglect at Marshall's home. Police were forced to put on gas masks due to a strong smell of urine. Inside, police say they found so many dogs that it was hard to move. All of the animals were seized and Marshall was briefly arrested. The incoming animals left Anchorage Animal Care and Control's shelter running at roughly triple its normal capacity, but shelter staff say residents came forward to help and have already adopted more than half of the seized animals. The shelter's manager says just 29 dogs from the home remained at the shelter today, and they're doing well. Some are not yet socialized, but all are anticipated to eventually be adoptable. Marshall could not be reached for comment today. She's set to make her next court appearance in late July. The Trump administration in March signed an executive order to dismantle the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which funds public library programs around the country. Although grants for some libraries have been restored, that's not the case in Alaska. As KDLL's Hunter Morrison reports, one program made for the state's rural communities could be sunsetted as a result.
Kids are playing in a room the size of a small house. It's lined with bookshelves, and the floor is dotted with children's toys. This is a typical day for the Moose Pass Public Library on the Kenai Peninsula. It's become a hub for the small community of about 80 people. And it's one of roughly 70 libraries in Alaska that participated in the state's interlibrary loan program, which stopped taking requests in May.
But yeah, a lot of people are like, well, that's, you know, it's a big inconvenience.
That's Danny Kostrak, Moose Pass Public Library Director. She says nearly 100 interlibrary loan requests were filled at the library since last summer. They included children's science fiction novels like The Wild Robot, vehicle repair manuals, and an Alaska climbing guide. The program, an 800 number, allowed rural residents to access books that smaller, far-flung libraries don't have the budget or space to buy. If a request couldn't be satisfied in state, the title would be pulled from a library in the lower 48.
Not everyone can just buy what they want either, so that's why they rely on libraries.
But that service could be eliminated entirely if Institute of Museum and Library Services funding isn't approved by the end of June. That organization is an independent federal agency that was targeted for cuts through a Trump administration executive order in March to reduce the, quote, scope of the federal bureaucracy. Altogether, the changes could significantly cut back services and programs for libraries across rural Alaska. Alaska isn't the only state where library programming has been impacted by President Trump's funding cuts. But already, some of the state's tribal libraries have had to scale back operating hours because of the order. Another program that mails books and DVDs to Alaskans who don't have a library in their community is also on the chopping block. The Institute of Museum and Library Services could not be reached for comment via email. Sandy Nipmeyer runs the 800 number interlibrary loan service at the Anchorage Public Library.
There is nothing in the state that will step in to provide that. I mean, it's really going to hurt them.
She says that's true for all Alaskans, especially those who live in villages with few library options to choose from. Virginia Morgan is library director of the Log Cabin Cooper Landing Community Library, which is housed on the Kenai Peninsula in a small log cabin with no running water. The library only serves about 200 people.
I don't think we've even started to comprehend how we're going to adapt yet. We are still sort of like a little bit shell-shocked at what's happening.
Jeanette Cadu is a patron of the Cooper Landing Community Library. Cadu has used the Interlibrary Loan 800 number several times. She once requested a style manual for a research paper she wrote. She says the title wasn't available in Cooper Landing.
If I lived in a large town, I would just go to that big library and get the book, and I would, you know, take my laptop in, and day after day I'd just go in and use that manual and get it done. But that's not really feasible in a little community like Cooper Landing.
She could have bought the title online, but says that isn't always an option for people who live in rural communities. Cadeau says her research paper wouldn't have been published in an academic journal without the style manual being sent through the loan program. And that's what rural libraries are afraid of. Here's Danica Strack with the Moose Pass Public Library.
And we do the best that we can, but ultimately there will just be more disappointment, and hopefully it doesn't deter people from coming and still utilizing what we do have to offer.
Meanwhile, a federal judge recently ordered the Trump administration to restore Institute of Museum and Library Services funding to 21 states that had filed a lawsuit over the executive order. Alaska wasn't one of those states, meaning future funding for the library programs is still uncertain. Reporting on the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Hunter Morrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how.
Hoonah's police chief submitted his resignation after less than 2 years in the role. Then the city fired him for misconduct. He says it was retaliation. KTOO's Clarice Larson reports from Hoonah.
The city of Hoonah's chief of police, Carlos Frias, submitted his resignation on Friday after he was placed on administrative leave. On Monday, he was informed that the city had declined it and terminated his employment. Frias says he was placed on leave because of an excessive use of force complaint. He argues the investigation was one-sided and aimed at removing him. He alleges he was pushed out of the role because he began investigating complaints of misconduct against some city leaders. City leaders deny the allegations and say he was fired for a series of violations, including excessive use of force. In an interview on Friday, Frias says he did not want to leave the role, but he said city officials told him he could resign or be fired.
A lot of it was just constant retaliation from the city, but the biggest thing was that they were already planning on firing me anyway.
Frias began his tenure as chief in the fall of 2023. He and his family moved to Hoonah from Tucson, Arizona, where he also worked in law enforcement. Hoonah is a small fishing community on the northeastern side of Chichagof Island, west of Juneau. Frias says he was investigating alleged domestic violence and sexual assault complaints made against some city leaders, along with other misconduct that he believes was being intentionally unreported.
As I was gathering more information on stuff that was going on within the city and I went to question the city, that's when everything just kind of went south. I was told, hey, you're not supposed to investigate that.
Hoonah's city attorney, Jim Sheehan, denies the allegations. In an interview on Monday, he said, quote, if he's alleging that his termination was a result of retaliation by the city or any official employer at the city, that's a false statement, unquote. Sheehan confirmed that Frias was placed on administrative leave on May 13th before he submitted his resignation, but declined to give a reason why on Monday afternoon. Later that day, city officials informed Frias he was fired for misconduct. Frias says he worries about the public's safety and residents' ability to report concerns or problems without fear of retaliation.
I did my homework here. I put in the work so that people can actually trust me here. And it's unfortunate that I have to leave because certain circumstances are getting me out of here.
The interim chief is Benjamin Botts, formerly with the Ketchikan Police Department. Sheehan says the city hasn't begun searching for a new permanent replacement for the chief, but he expects to see that happen in the coming days. Frias can choose to appeal the decision to terminate him. He says he plans to leave Hoonah as soon as he can. In Hoonah, I'm Clarice Larson.
May was a record-breaking month for rain in southeast Alaska. Petersburg, Ketchikan, Haines, and Skagway all received record amounts of monthly rainfall. Across the panhandle, many communities saw double or triple the amount of rainfall they normally get. Most communities also experienced colder-than-average temperatures. National Weather Service meteorologist Zoe Kaplan says that this kind of weather is unusual in spring.
This whole event is pretty anomalous because these are totals that we would normally see in the fall. But I guess it's continued through the winter and made it through the spring as well.
The region's rain can be blamed on a series of atmospheric rivers sweeping through southeast. Atmospheric rivers are a thick band of moisture that can carry a lot of water from warm regions to cooler ones.
Usually we get around weak atmospheric rivers around here just because we're so far north, but there was a really good stream of moisture coming from the tropics for this one, and we were seeing moderate values for this atmospheric river, so it just kind of funneled all of that moisture right into the panhandle.
Most of the rain was in the southern part of southeast. Ketchikan was hit the hardest, receiving over 25 inches of rain. The impacts of climate change can make weather events like this more severe, but Kaplan says that this May's deluge should not be a future trend for Southeast.
This isn't necessarily a normal event that would happen every year, and it probably won't become a tradition or anything like that, so you don't have to worry, but it definitely is possible. So when things like this all come together, then it can create some crazy things in the atmosphere.
Looking forward, Kaplan says that while June will still be wet, it won't be as wet as May. The rain will continue, but there should be more breaks between the showers in the coming weeks. The Juneau School District is expanding its support of a local language immersion program. After multiple meetings and extended debate, the school board has agreed to fund more of the Thlingit Language Immersion Program in the upcoming school year, even amid statewide school budgeting concerns. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
The program in question is Atkuaha, Expanding the Thlingit Culture, Language, and Literacy Program, or TCLL. The school district and the nonprofit arm of a regional Native corporation have historically roughly split the cost. The school board signed a memorandum of agreement Wednesday with the Alaska Heritage Institute to increase its investment in the project. But school board members brought up questions about whether the district should pay for more of the TCLL program amidst widespread concerns about funding. Board member Elizabeth Sidden said the school supports TCLL, but they have to balance that with the needs of the entire district.
But we support it amongst how we support all of our 4,000 students. So I'm trying to keep in mind that these 119 are not the only students we're responsible for.
The school board initially approved the change during its budget process. They were then under the impression that the grant SHI used for the program was ending, according to the school board president. But SHI was later approved for an extension of the grant. The program isn't growing, but now the school district will fund 8 of its 11 positions. And the change requires additional funding from the school district's budget. SHI Education Director Christy Ford said the program is intended to increase the number of Tlingit language speakers.
We have less than 10 fluent speakers left, so the need and the urgency to put intensive amount of support and instruction into the TCLL program was asked of us.
In recent meetings, some school board members said the program only serves a small percentage of Juno students. But Ford said the scope is intentional. It's intense and immersive, so that there's a group of dedicated speakers to make sure the Tlingit language doesn't go extinct. In Juno, I'm Yvonne Kremery.
A 9-year-old has won the Sitka Salmon Derby for the second time in 3 years. Caleb Gray brought in the biggest fish near the beginning of the 5-day event, and no one else ever came close. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Caleb Gray is standing on the weigh-in barge in Sitka's Crescent Harbor Sunday afternoon as the seconds count down toward the end of the 70th Sitka Salmon Derby. There's always a chance someone might come charging in right at the wire with a bigger fish, but no other boats are in sight. Caleb sounds the horn, bringing the derby to an end and sealing his victory. It's deja vu all over again as he performed this same task 2 years ago as a 7-year-old.
Sound the horn! That's the unofficial.
Gray will take home $20,000 prize money if the result stands, and it likely will. His 34-pound king was over 2 pounds larger than his nearest competitor. Todd Nevers will take second place with a 31.8-pound king. Jeremiah Johnson will take third with a 30.8-pound king. All results are unofficial until the awards ceremony on June 12th in Harrigan Centennial Hall. With a one-fish bag limit, this was not the largest derby, but participants did surprisingly well despite gale-force winds that blew through on both weekends. 155 people fished in the event, turning in 312 kings, weighing an average of 15 pounds. Collectively, that makes about 4,700 pounds of fish. Only 12 competitors turned in a fish each of the 5 days of the derby. That kept total poundage averages below a more typical event with a larger bag limit and better conditions. In addition to his third-place win, Jeremiah Johnson will claim the total poundage prize with 101.5 pounds. Riley Bernhardt, who won total poundage in 2019 as an 11-year-old, is in second place with 96.7 pounds, and Kerry Gray will take third with 95.7 pounds. Kerry Gray is the mother of 2-time champion Caleb Gray. Their boat, by the way, is the appropriately named Relentless. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jamie Deep and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Chris Clint in Anchorage, Hunter Morrison on the Kenai Peninsula, Clarice Larson in Hoonah, Taylor Heckert in Petersburg, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training. ConocoPhillips Alaska, committed to Alaska for more than 50 years.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Now that I've tried to talk to you and make you understand, all you have to do is close your eyes and just reach out your hands and touch me. Hold me close, don't
To you. Every little thing that you do. The smell of your skin, the taste of your kiss, the way you whisper in the dark. Your hair all around me, baby, you surround me. You touch every place in my heart.